In this first hour of the show, we'll be talking about the Central American Free Trade Agreement, generally known by its initials, CAFTA. CAFTA would remove or lower trade barriers between the United States and six countries, Costa Rica, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua, and the Dominican Republic. President Bush has argued that CAFTA would be good for American manufacturers because it would further open the markets of these countries to goods made in the United States. Also, the president said that the agreement will be good for the economies of these countries, helping them to develop, and will also help make the governments of these countries more stable. CAFTA has passed the Senate. However, it has run into opposition in the House from both Democrats and Republicans, who fear that it will increase job loss and make it more difficult for American manufacturers, particularly in the sugar industry and the textile industry, to compete with cheaper imports coming in from outside of the United States. It is likely that it will come up for a vote in the House this week, or at least according to recent stories that I have read, and there seems to be a pretty good chance that it will fail. And if that happens, it would be the first time since Lyndon Johnson was president that a president failed to get a trade agreement that he had wanted through the Congress. We'll be talking this morning about CAFTA in this hour of the show with Robert Scott. He's Director of International Programs at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. He joined the Institute as an international economist in 1996. Before that, he was assistant professor with the College of Business and Management at University of Maryland at College Park. Has published research in a number of professional journals, that is, economic journals, Journal of Policy Analysis and Management, International Review of Applied Economics. He's also written editorial pieces for the Los Angeles Times, Newsday, USA Today, the Baltimore Sun, and other newspapers. He's also represented American industries as an expert witness on the economic effects of imports in several cases before the U.S. International Trade Commission concerning unfair trade complaints. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are welcome for people who are listening. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief. And we ask that so that we could get in as many callers as possible and keep the program moving. But of course, people who are listening, it's certainly welcome for you to call in with questions and comments. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number to call, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call for you, if you're listening around Illinois, Indiana, or over the Internet, use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Again, in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Dr. Scott, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
We certainly appreciate it. Give us the basics on CAFTA. What would CAFTA do?
CAFTA would lower tariff barriers and quotas between the United States and Central America, and it would primarily this would affect Central American and Dominican exports to the U.S. But more importantly, it would also set up a special set of trade and investment and investment and intellectual property protections for U.S. businesses doing business in Central America.
Mm-hmm. Is this essentially just like NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement of 94, or is there something about this that is substantially different?
It's different in two ways. One, I think it expands NAFTA into the services industry, so now governments are going to be forced to open up markets like water systems and education and healthcare to private competition, things we don't even have in the United States and could affect the U.S. And it's also going to be a wedge to expand NAFTA to the whole Western Hemisphere, a much, much bigger enterprise.
Mm-hmm. Your position on this, is this good, bad, otherwise?
I think this will be a really serious problem for workers in Central America and also for the U.S. to the extent that it could lead to a bigger free trade agreement of the Americas.
Mm-hmm. Well, specifically, the administration has argued that this is good for American industry because it, as you say, it lowers barriers. It makes it easier for American manufacturers to sell their goods in these countries. Is that not the case?
Well, it was the same argument, exactly the same argument they made with respect to NAFTA. Let me just quote from a 1993 report. It says, NAFTA will level a playing field that remains, despite recent Mexican openings, substantially tilted in Mexico's favors. Mexico's tariff barriers are 2.5 times higher than our tariffs on Mexico's. That was the claim. What we've seen is that imports have increased, have tripled. Exports have gone up about 100%, and so we've lost, our trade balance has trade deficit has increased, and that's eliminated about a million U.S. jobs.
Mm-hmm. What about on the other side? The argument has been made, at least the administration has made the argument, this would be good for these countries because, again, it would give an opportunity for them to develop their industry, to sell products in the United States, to take advantage of products that are manufactured here in this country, perhaps at a better price than what they can get at home. Is this good, bad, otherwise for these six countries in Central America?
It's a mirage. This was what was promised to workers and businesses in Mexico. In fact, we've seen the opposite. We've seen real wages fall in Mexico. We've seen Mexico's overall balance of trade with the world plummet. And so while they've gotten more trade with the U.S., improved trade balance globally, they're hurting. And that ultimately is going to undermine the Mexican economy as well. And I'm very concerned we'll see the same thing happen to Central America. In fact, in Mexico, they've lost about 400 export factories just in the last 4 years as those firms have moved plants to China. And that's the real core issue here.
Mm-hmm. I think that some people have actually made the argument that because these, particularly in comparison to the United States, these economies are relatively small, even taken all together, and that in fact it won't, as far as the United States is concerned, it really won't make very much difference if we lower these trade barriers and make it possible for American companies to sell in Central America even more easily than it had been in the past, that, or things to go the other way around, that it really won't make very much difference because, as I said, taken all together, the economies of these countries are really quite small.
Well, I think that that's to a large extent true, but I think it's mistaken for two reasons. One, this is going to substantially weaken the enforcement of labor rights in the Caribbean and Central America. And so that's going to put additional downward pressure on wages in both countries or both regions. And two, as I said earlier, this is really all about driving a wedge into the move to expand NAFTA to the entire Western Hemisphere, and that will have very large effects on U.S. labor markets and U.S. consumers.
Hmm. We have a caller here we'll bring into conversation in just a moment. I want to reintroduce our guest and also pass on a little bit of weather information that our meteorologist has just handed to me. The Storm Prediction Center has issued a severe thunderstorm watch for much of northern Illinois, effective this Monday morning and afternoon until 5 o'clock, hail to 2 inches in diameter, thunderstorm wind gust to 70 miles an hour, and dangerous lightning are possible in these areas. And in our immediate AM 580 severe weather coverage area, this severe thunderstorm watch includes Ford County. Remember, a severe thunderstorm watch means conditions are favorable for severe storms in and close to the watch area. Keep an eye on the sky for threatening weather conditions and stay tuned to AM 580 for the latest weather information and possible warnings. Again, this is a severe thunderstorm watch in effect for much of northern Illinois until 5 o'clock this afternoon. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Robert Scott. He's Director of International Programs at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. We're talking about CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, and questions are welcome. We're getting some folks lined up. We have someone to start with listening this morning in Champaign, and we will go right there. This is line number one. Hello.
Hi, I just had a couple things. The first question that I had was you had mentioned that NAFTA's really been kind of a failure. Could you explain, I'm not sure why the Senate would even consider passing it if NAFTA was such a failure. And the other thing I was hoping you could talk about, maybe you had said this is going to affect labor rights, if you could talk about how this will affect environment as well. Thanks.
Well, okay, go ahead, Dr. Scott.
Sure. The NAFTA agreement was really a failure, I think, for, as I said, for both countries. I just want to explain briefly that the underlying economics of what's going on here. An increase in exports increases demand for U.S. goods. It puts U.S. workers to work. And typically when we hear businesses and the administration talking about the benefits of trade, they talk only about exports. But if we look at the economy overall, we have to look at exports and imports. Imports tend to displace domestic production and to push U.S. workers out of jobs, good jobs in the manufacturing industries, and into lower-paying jobs in the services like restaurants and retail trade, Walmart, where we have minimum wages and no benefits. So I think that's a big part of why NAFTA has failed. It also NAFTA has Mexico has very weak environmental and public health and standards, and I think that's driven down environmental standards in both countries. And so, just to take the second question, I think that because Central America has likely become a dumping ground for U.S. Hazardous waste, just as we found in Mexico, I think that will put downward pressure on environmental standards in the U.S. Also, under both CAFTA and NAFTA, U.S. companies and other foreign companies have special rights, unprecedented rights, to sue governments when they think that environmental and other laws have threatened their right to earn a profit. And in fact, there was a case where a company in Canada making the gasoline additive MBTE sued the state of California when they tried to regulate that chemical, even though it was cancer-causing and had polluted hundreds of wells in the state, sued them for $1 billion. So this has had a chilling effect on environmental regulations all around the country. Now, turning back to the first question, the Senate. The Senate has historically passed almost anything called a trade agreement, no matter what the terms were. This is the senators are, because they represent broad state interest, they're very, very dependent on the support of multinational businesses to provide the campaign contributions they need to stay in office. So I think this really affects the politics of trade in the Senate. And yet, despite all that, this is the closest vote we've ever had in the Senate on trade, at least in modern times. So the Senate even is becoming much more responsive to concerns about the dangers of these kinds of particular trade agreements. It's not free trade. It's a particular set of deals designed, in this case, to benefit large U.S. firms, expensive workers, consumers.
As you say, the vote was close in the Senate. It was 54 to 45.
Right.
And it's my understanding, at least according to the most recent articles that I have read, that it's likely that the House is going to vote on this week. Now, you may know better than that than I, but that also, according to these recent articles, that someone speaking for the administration admitted that they didn't have the votes in the House to pass it.
I think that's right. The latest thing that I read said that there were 29 Republicans opposed and about 6 Democrats in favor. And so if you add those numbers up, they're about 8 or 10 votes short of what they need to pass the agreement at this point.
So who wants this? Who wants CAFTA passed?
Oh, this is unambiguously clear. It is strictly the goal of multinational businesses. They are the ones who benefit most. I think there are a number of small businesses who come out against CAFTA because they've seen that their markets are being decimated as production has moved offshore to countries like Mexico and Central America and China. I think the administration is also very supportive of this, both because it's heavily influenced by those big businesses and because it's dominated by lawyers and economists who have almost dogmatic ideological commitment to negotiating any kind of trade deal, anything that reduces barriers to foreign investment or controls on foreign investment or any kind of rules, in part because they believe in their hearts that it's going to deregulate the U.S. economy. That's really their goal. And I think that's not in the interest of most workers or consumers.
Well, let's talk with someone else. The next caller is in Urbana, here where we are, line number 2. Hello.
Hello. What really bothers me about this NAFTA-CAFTA type of process is they talk a lot about, okay, increasing profits through exports, lower prices of imports, but little or nothing is said about workers' rights. And it seems to me we're starting the whole vicious cycle again of the Communist Manifesto, when Marx and Engels said, workers unite, we have nothing to lose but our chains. And that instigated the whole process of almost having a worldwide nuclear holocaust. And I don't understand why they don't have some workers' right. What is the situation there? What can be done about that?
Well, I think this is a very important point to be educated about. There are, in fact, some workers' rights provisions in this CAFTA agreement, but they are really just for show. They're incredibly watered down. And, in fact, they are much weaker than the labor rights provisions that exist in current U.S. trade law, and I'll explain the difference. In CAFTA, countries are encouraged to enforce their existing labor rights. And if they're found to violate those labor rights, they can be fined, but only up to a maximum of $15 million. But more importantly, when they're fined, the U.S. government turns around and gives them back the money. Money is fungible. There's nothing that says they can't cut their labor enforcement budgets by that much or more and simply use the fine to make up the difference. So there's really no effective enforcement in this agreement at all. Under existing U.S. trade law, specifically the Caribbean Basin Initiative and the Generalized System of Preferences, the U.S. has the right to suspend trade benefits, that is, to reimpose tariffs that it's agreed to eliminate, if a country fails to maintain its labor law, rights for workers, or fails to attempt to improve those labor rights. So there's actually pressure to raise labor rights to internationally accepted ILO labor standards. And there have been a number of cases in which these laws have been used to force countries and companies to comply with their own labor laws and with those international standards.
Would you expand upon that provision you mentioned in CAFTA, which says that like a country like Canada can sue when their business profits are endangered by environmental concerns? Are there any other cases like the MTBE that you mentioned?
Yeah, there have been at least 30 of these cases, and I think it's important to understand what we're doing here. These treaties have allowed companies to sue governments. It's not Canada suing the U.S., it's the Methyl Corporation suing the United States and the state of California for benefits. This is unprecedented. In international law previously, it was always countries putting pressure on or having disagreements with other countries, like we do with the WTO and the Europeans on export subsidies. Right? We're having a battle over that right now in the WTO. But in NAFTA and in CAFTA, this is totally different. It's companies, multinational companies, suing states and countries. And we've never allowed companies to do that before. And for example, there was a case of a state regulation on funeral home operators that was designed to limit monopolies coming in, buying up all the funeral homes and raising prices to all the poor families that were trying to take care of the needs of their deceased family members. And this law was actually thrown out by one of these tribunals, and these tribunals operate in secret. They're composed of so-called trade experts, and in fact, there is no way to appeal one of these decisions. So once they make a decision, you either have to pay the fine or eliminate the regulation. And that's happened in Mexico as well with a toxic waste dump. The citizens tried to close, but the government of Mexico was actually forced to pay about $25 million in that case to the to the company that wanted to open up this toxic waste dump. So these provisions have been used over and over again to weaken labor enforcement, and I think it's been it's clearly shown that this is bad for communities and workers.
Well, thank you so much.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to next someone else. This is someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Oh, I'm on line two. Anyway, I'm a supporter of the environment, very much so, and anti-war. But I've been thinking about this outsourcing that's going out of the country. Our country's consumed about 40%, I think, of natural resources, and we're gluttons over here, doing better than everybody else in the world. I think it's time for us to let this even up. And the more factories that are built in other countries, hey, you know, it's going to increase the standard of living for all those people that don't have as much or who are poor. And I think this is an evening out process. And maybe if we have factories over there and more business, maybe we'll have more influence on the environment in the long run. What's your comment on that?
Well, the problem we've seen is that when these factories move abroad, we've seen that they, in fact, tend to be less energy efficient. We've seen that in China. China is just a voracious consumer of all kinds of energy, especially oil. And they're one of the major reasons that oil prices have doubled in the last 2 years. China has suddenly become the second largest oil importer in the world. I think what we have to do when we think about expanding trade is to step back and ask what's good for consumers, what's good for workers in both countries. Under NAFTA, we've seen living standards actually fall. Real wages fell. We've seen 1.5 million agricultural jobs eliminated in Mexico. We've seen illegal immigration double. This agreement just isn't working for poor workers and poor farmers in Mexico. If that's what we want to do, we just did it badly. We really have to go back and examine these agreements from the ground up and ask, how can we put them together in a way that helps workers and helps consumers? One thing I think we could do on the environmental front, I think that would directly help everybody, would be to kick off a major, what we call an Apollo program, Apollo project, to invest in energy-efficient and renewable technologies.
Yeah.
And we could sell those both here and to the rest of the world. So we could produce things, they could get the benefit of clean energy technology, and we could all benefit from those kinds of investments.
How do you? That's true. How do you feel though about sharing the jobs? I feel like it's at this point in time, it's a good idea because I think we've taken too much and given too little.
Well, I think that we have to separate the question of jobs. I think we should certainly reduce our consumption of resources, but you're right. Workers in both countries need jobs. I think that what we need to do is think about ways to create jobs in the poorer countries and in the U.S. And in fact, there are other ways to expand employment. The best model is in Europe. 25 or 30 years ago, Greece and Spain and Portugal were the poor countries in Europe. They were the underdeveloped regions like Mexico, and the European Union decided to unify with them. But when they did, they actually spent money putting people to work and educating people and raising living standards. And in that way, when those countries joined the European Union, the European Common Market, as they called it then, the levels of employment, the levels of wages and incomes were rising in both the North and the South. And I think the point is there are different ways to write trade agreements. There are trade agreements that raise living standards in both the poor and the wealthier countries, and there are trade agreements that create a race to the bottom, and that's what we're doing under NAFTA and CAFTA.
I see. One more question. Do you feel like there's the World Bank and some of these other groups are getting in the way of the Millennium Agreement?
Well, I think the World Bank is continuing to, and the IMF in particular, are continuing to promote a I think, a failed trade and investment policy. They put great emphasis on trade deals like NAFTA. They put great emphasis on cutting government spending and cutting regulation in ways that reduce wages and incomes and the quality of life in developing countries. And when they offer debt relief, it's often with such tight strings attached that it just decimates the economies of the countries involved.
And they come up with terms like risk assessment, which puts it off.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. We are here at our midpoint, and we have some other calls we'll get to in just a moment. Let me introduce again our guest, Robert Scott. He is Director of International Programs at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. First joined the Institute as an international economist in 1996. Before that, was assistant professor in the College of Business and Management at University of Maryland at College Park. And we're talking about CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Next up, someone in Champaign County, and this is line number 3. Hello.
Hi, good morning. I wanted you to expand on a couple of things. Well, one that you haven't covered yet, and you mentioned the dislocation of the countryside. Everybody's concentrating on factories being built in Mexico, or the last caller was, and how it was going to improve the lot of the poor there. But if one looks at what NAFTA did by dumping subsidized grain on Mexico, I mean, you can draw a line between that and the, you know, death of people on the border, because you know, that's why they've been dislocated. The grain that we're subsidizing but with tax dollars is being dumped on Mexico and dislocating the countryside. The other thing is, and this is an effect of, again, on Mexico and Central America with CAFTA, is the point that the big pharma is very involved in lobbying for this. And I've just heard a fact that, or an assertion, and I would like for you to confirm it, that access to drugs, pharmaceuticals, is going to be quite restricted in the usual way by increasing the cost in Central America because of this. So there's going to be a lot of repercussions that we would... Well, anyway, I think it might catch my drift if we could cover those two issues.
No, I think I can talk about both points, and I really appreciate you raising them. They're both very important issues. I think that farmers, both north and south, in the U.S. and in Mexico, have suffered greatly under this, in terms of the NAFTA agreement, and I think we can expect something similar under CAFTA. Under NAFTA, you're right. We shipped a lot of very low-cost grain to Mexico, and in fact, Mexico was authorized to protect its peasant farmers for up to, I think, 15 years under the agreement, and they just threw that aside and threw open the Mexican market to imports of corn and beans from the U.S. And as a result, as I think I mentioned earlier, they lost about 1.5 million agricultural jobs in Mexico, and as a consequence, people have flooded the cities, and that has created lots of subsistence level work, people selling trinkets on the street corners and food stands and that sort of thing. But it's also doubled illegal immigration to the U.S., and that raises the point you talked about. We're seeing hundreds and thousands of people die each year trying to get across that border, often, in many cases, only to be captured by the border control agents and shipped back home again. Many people come two and three times just trying to get here. And they're abused and exploited here in the U.S. when they arrive. So I think it's a lose-lose proposition for farmers in Mexico. In the U.S., even though we're shipping more grain to Mexico, what we've seen is that the benefits that were promised haven't accrued to farmers. The USDA said before NAFTA that corn exports to NAFTA would go up. and that, quote, farm prices for corn would be about 6 cents a bushel higher. Likewise, they said farm prices for soybeans would be higher. In fact, as you may know, looking at the averages between 91-93 and 2001-03, corn prices fell by 6 cents a bushel, about 3%. Soybean prices are down 10% a bushel, about 2%. And overall, it has been a complete failure for the farm sector. We look at the broad numbers. We can go on more about that later if we get another call on the subject, or if you'd like to talk about it.
Well, the one follow-up, if I could, is
sure.
That you say that it's been bad for the farm sector. Well, I don't think that's exactly right. I think Cargill and the large, almost multinational grain exporters, which are tied in very closely with big pharma these days because of cross investments, et cetera.
Right.
That they're doing very well, thank you, and the farmers in both countries are suffering. Appreciate your efforts. Thanks.
Sure. Thank you for the call. You're absolutely right. Cargill and ConAgra, these are multinational companies that benefit from grain trade no matter what the price is. All they do is mark it up. They could care less at what price. And, in fact, the lower the price, the better. They sell more. But they have no concern with the effect on producers in either the U.S. or Mexico or Central America. And I think the connection to pharmaceuticals, which you mentioned, is very important. A unique part of this agreement and NAFTA is that we'll force these countries to adhere to not only to U.S. Patent laws and intellectual property protections, but it will actually extend those patent protections additional years. And this is one reason why a Planned Parenthood, for example, has come out against the CAFTA agreement. They're concerned that it will make birth control medications too expensive for many women in Central America to afford. So it will actually increase population problems. And the problems of women experience, poor women in particular experience in these countries with large families.
All right, let's go on. We have another caller here in Charleston, line 4. Hello.
Yes, thus far the conversation is centered around symptoms for the most part, and I'd like to give a little historical perspective to the whole situation of what the early capitalist understood as laissez-faire. When the French, you know, were the first to overwhelm the monarchy, which was in the monarchy in cahoots with the church and feudalism, and they ran the whole thing pretty much like the capitalists run society now, when self-interest and the acquiring of money and power, or whatever is considered power, and that's what makes everything so hyper in this day and age. Marx wrote in the Poverty of Philosophy that it took 300 years for the bourgeoisie or the merchant class to accede to power in Western Europe. Well, we're somewhere near 200 years or a little over now, and if, as another gentleman tried to express, the overthrow of capitalism by the workers, which would lead to nuclear holocaust, you know, I think that's pretty much of a stretch. I mean, no system has ever came into being in human society thus far without its period of violence. And that is horrendous on its face. But I don't think that the merchant class had any compunction about overwhelming the church and creating all the problems that blew on to ignorant people. And then themselves began to go down the same road, which capitalism is what it is, and it was a step forward. But now look what it is doing, and this whole conversation this morning, both from listeners and from your guest and from David yourself, are the symptoms of this decayed mass that we call capitalism, which feeds only a few. And as another lady said, 40% of the world's goods are consumed in the U.S. by a minority here. There is a huge mass of poor people who live on the edge right here in the USA who cannot afford health care, cannot afford proper food, or any of the other amenities that capitalism has brought forward, and it's just time for it to go. And I don't know what you think of that, but I'll hang up and listen, and thank you very much.
Well, Dr. Scott, you can comment on that any way you like.
Well, it's an interesting call. I think the caller raises important points. What we live in a society here in the United States that is in a political system that is really dominated by large multinational businesses and by the interests of the very well-to-do people in our society. As I think Michael Moore caught the president saying on his recent movie, entertaining, at a dinner, speaking at dinner, and he said, these are, you are my real friends, my real supporters, the haves and the have-mores. And I think that there's a lot of truth in that. When it comes to trade agreements, I want to make clear, I'm not a protectionist. I think trade is good. I think it can raise living standards in both the rich and the poor countries if it's done with a view towards exactly that, towards raising living standards. If that's our primary goal, if we begin with the question of how can we make people better off, then I think we can negotiate trade agreements that really help. The problem we have is that the trade agreements we've been negotiating are really dictated by multinational businesses. They're designed to tilt the playing field in favor of multinational companies and against workers, against communities, against the states, and there's been a fundamental shift of power away from working people and the citizens in this country in favor of a big business. And in other parts of the world, as I think I said, we've seen trade agreements that can help poor workers become wealthier, as they did in the European Union about 25 or 30 years ago. So I think here we have a system where our political process is dominated by contributions from big business and by the super rich. I think in Europe you have a political system that is much more democratic, that involves much less input and control by the forces of big business. And as a result, you get different kinds of trade policy.
We are moving into our last 15 minutes here on Focus 580 in the first hour of the show. Again, just very quickly, let me introduce our guest. We're talking with Robert Scott. He is Director of International Programs at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. And we're talking about CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement. It's an agreement that will remove or lower trade barriers between the United States and six other countries, Costa Rica, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua, and the Dominican Republic. It has passed the Senate, however, has met with a lot of opposition in the House from both Republicans and Democrats, although the president said he's argued that it would be good for American manufacturers and also for the American economy and the economy of these countries in Central America. Others have made the arguments that you've heard our guest make this morning, saying that in fact it would be bad for the American economy and also for these economies as well. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we'll talk next with someone in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Yeah, I have two basic questions. One is, as you just mentioned, you've said that if we followed more in the European model, we could help the raise the standards of living without crushing one segment of our society, but you're not very specific about what exactly would be different about either NAFTA or CAFTA if we did follow the European model. Can you talk about what parts would be dropped and what parts would be added? And then number two, I think I better ask these together. The other one was that I've heard you say that imports tripled under NAFTA, whereas exports only doubled, I believe, or something like that. And so the imports increased a great deal, but the whole idea before NAFTA was that we were told that the tariffs were a lot higher in the foreign countries, in the other countries, and that so it doesn't make sense that you remove the tariffs in the other countries and then the imports here increase. What exactly happened there? You know, if those questions are clear, I think I'll hang up and listen over the radio.
Those are excellent questions. Let me start with the second. How could imports increase faster than exports when all of the barriers were allegedly in Mexico? And the truth is that these are free trade and investment agreements, and the emphasis is much more on investment than it is on trade. What these agreements did was to guarantee investors the right to do business in Mexico and in Canada without any restrictions. In the past, these countries put conditions on foreign investors. They said, if you want to work here, invest here, you have to hire local managers, you have to share the technology with local companies, you have to build up a supplier network. All of that was thrown out completely under NAFTA. And so, and companies were given guarantees that those rules would never be changed. Essentially, it froze the Mexican and Canadian legal systems and said, established a line saying, you shall never impose any further conditions on these multinational companies. So, of course, it was all about moving plants abroad. It was not about shipping more goods from here to Mexico. In fact, what we ship to Mexico and Canada now are almost entirely parts that are assembled in those lower wage countries and shipped back here. That's why we have to look at what happens, not just to trade flows, but to the balance of trade. If we take an engine that used to be built into a car in Detroit and now we ship it to Mexico, it looks like an export, but we haven't put anybody to work. What comes back is an assembled car that displaces one that might have been built in Fort Wayne or Normal, Illinois, and where we also have auto plants. And this is simply a lose-lose proposition for workers in the U.S. Now, to go back to your earlier question about Europe, how could we do it differently so everybody wins? In the European case, what they did was they set up what they called social cohesion funds, and these are really development funds, and they transferred large amounts of money. It amounted to 2% of the output of those countries before they came into the European Union, and that amount doubled after they came in. So they created real incentives for these countries to reform, and in particular for them to become more democratic. And they got more money if they became more democratic and met the criteria to join the union. And then the money was spent on things like education and infrastructure and housing, things that would both raise the standards of the labor force and put people to work. And that last element is so important. It's creating real demand for workers, creates real jobs, not based on some distorting trade flows, but based on domestic demand for goods and services. That's the really effective way to grow an economy, is to do it by your own bootstraps. And Europe helped them do that.
If someone wants to call in here real quick, we could perhaps get one or two callers in the time that remains. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. As you have said, and I think in fact that that the administration is pretty clear about what they would like to see is the kind of approach that has been taken with NAFTA, and they would like to take in CAFTA, extended to all of the Americas and all of the countries of Latin America, of South America, and that they think that passing CAFTA is an important first step. And as you have said, it's the thin edge of the wedge. If CAFTA doesn't pass, and it looks like it may not get through the House in spite of the Bush administration's effort to try to persuade enough Republicans to vote for it to get it through, then what happens with the administration's interest in seeing the free trade area of the Americas come into being?
Well, we've already seen, I think, some of the repercussions. In fact, the FTAA negotiations have come to a halt because of the opposition of the countries in the southern cone of South America, what's called the Mercosur region. They have their own common market. It involves Brazil and Argentina and Paraguay and Uruguay. And within that agreement, there's actually an effort to raise living standards amongst the four countries to support the kinds of things we're talking about that they did in the European Union. They have what they call a social contract that supports living standards and provides real benefits to workers in need. And that would be threatened by NAFTA and by the FTA. So they're simply drawing a line and saying, we're not going to give up our right to control our economic destiny. And so that's already thrown a real block in the path of the FTA. I think that if CAFTA is stopped, that will really force a reexamination of what we're trying to achieve with these trade deals in the Western Hemisphere.
We have a couple of callers here. We'll try to get at least one of them here, starting with Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes, hello. I thought I heard one of the senators comment that having CAFTA pass would maybe allow for another backdoor for more imports from China. And I was wondering if you could discuss that at all.
Yes, that's one of the sticking points. There is a clause in the apparel sector, technically called tariff preference levels, that allow Nicaragua in particular to import textiles from China and then turn them into clothes and ship them to the U.S. So all the alleged benefits for textile producers here would be eliminated. And more generally, I think the whole idea that we're going to transport to transplant apparel production there is really a mirage. We've seen that in Mexico. China is just swamping the world apparel market because its wages are impossibly low, 10 cents an hour. There's no way even that Central America and the Dominican Republic can compete with wages that low. I think, fantasy to think it can help either the U.S. textile industry or those poor workers in those countries.
Thank you.
All right, and one more caller here, also locally, Champaign-Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Yes, interesting. The Times said that a livestock rancher in Mexico said, we're all middlemen now, but could you comment on their old system called the ejido, and for a long time they always wanted to control their oil. What's happening to that now?
Well, there's pressure under NAFTA and under CAFTA to privatize the oil system. I think Pemex is still a nationally owned company, but there is increasing pressure, and there will be under CAFTA as well, to force countries to sell off these state-owned enterprises. And while you can maybe have a difference of opinion about something like oil, I think it's quite clear that in areas like public services, like water and schools, that there's just no way that the private sector can be responsive to the public interest in providing high-quality services in these areas and to the mass of people. And we've seen that where these plans have been tried in other countries and have had disastrous results.
Hmm. We know that there has been, certainly since NAFTA, there has been, well, even when NAFTA was under discussion, there was organized opposition to that from organized labor. And now, when we're talking about CAFTA, once again, organized labor has spoken out against it, and also some industries have spoken out against it. I would expect that before NAFTA, probably the average American didn't think very much about trade agreements, but that now, as a result of the kind of attention that NAFTA and now CAFTA has gotten, there probably are at least a few more people who are thinking about this. Do you see any sort of widespread consciousness raising, or at least an increase in the number of people who actually pay attention to think about issues like this?
Well, I think this is has risen to the level of public consciousness, and I think people generally have looked at these agreements and decided they don't work very well. One recent poll that I saw showed that majorities or pluralities of citizens throughout the country were opposed to the CAFTA agreement. I think it was a 2-to-1 amongst Democrats and Independents, and something like 47-to-32 amongst Republicans. More opposed than supported the CAFTA agreement. So it doesn't depend on what party you belong in. In most regions of the country, amongst most groups of workers, people understand these agreements are not helping them.
Well, there, we'll leave it and we'll let you go. Thank you very much for giving us your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our guest, Robert Scott, he is Director of International Programs at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C.